Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophonous cavalcade of conversation. Thanks for spending some time with us tonight. It's balmy here in the desert, starting to warm up in the afternoons, but thankfully we have a few weeks to go before the blast furnace onslaught begins. Hope the snow is melting wherever you live, but not so fast that it floods you out. Just returned from the UFO MegaCon event in Laughlin, a week-long event that I mentioned last Sunday. Huge number of speakers and panels that cover just about any coast-to-coast topic you can imagine. Got to spend a little time with George Norrie and with Tom Danheiser. Also with David O'Leary, the creator of the History Channel drama series Project Blue Book. He says season two is already in production. Dropped a couple of hints about the real-life UFO cases that will serve as inspiration for dramatized episodes to come in season two. And he explained the obvious, that this program is not a documentary, it's not a history film, it's a scripted drama, fictionalized version of events and people. So, you know, it takes liberties with some of the real life details about these cases, but David defended the overall intentions of helping to educate the public about incidents and cases and investigations that would otherwise be forgotten, and inspire viewers to do some of their own digging. Interesting guy. Heard some terrific presentations from speakers who've been guests here on this program. Peter Robbins talking about his mentor, Bud Hopkins. Cheryl Costa spoke about new data on UFO sightings. Jeremy Corbell on the 30th anniversary to the day of a video recorded by Bob Lazar of a glowing object floating above Papoose Lake in the desert. More on that in a moment. And maybe the biggest surprise of this event, Richard Doty. You know that name? Former Air Force Office of Special Investigations Counterintelligence Officer Rick Doty. He's essentially been considered a UFO boogeyman for 30-plus years, a walking, talking MIB type. But there he was, telling his side of a really interesting story about his days carrying out orders and mixing it up with ufologists. No one was seen carrying torches or pitchforks when he left the stage, so I asked him to come on the show sometime, and he agreed to later this year. Our webmaster, by the way, Greg Bishop, tonight wrote a book that focused on Rick Doty and that intriguing period in UFO history. The book is called Project Beta. You should check it out sometime. Anyway, a good time was had by all, or at least by most. I want to mention a special listener out there in Radio Land tonight. Our friend and colleague, Dr. Jacques Vallée, told me about him and described him as not only a faithful Coast listener, but a national treasure. His name is Jack Katz. He lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. And according to Dr. Vallée, he is the last surviving artist of the generation that produced Superman, Batman, all those other superheroes in the great comics of yesteryear. He is essentially the inventor of the graphic novel genre. Wow. We're thrilled to have Jack as part of the Coast family, and maybe we can get him on the program, talk about his work sometime. Tonight, we cast a wide net. We build ourselves a huge tent, open a big umbrella that encompasses a smorgasbord of the unusual and unknown, with two investigators who came at their subjects from different angles, but both ended up essentially in the same place and with the same general conclusion, that all this weird stuff is somehow related. Steve Mira is one of the best-known UFO investigators in the UK. He has literally written the book for UFO investigations and investigators there and elsewhere, and he publishes an online magazine that's read all over the world. But he found his work on UFO cases led down some very strange paths into the realm of phenomena that we might characterize as paranormal or supernatural. His colleague, an Irish investigator named Barry Fitzgerald, started on the supernatural side of things and made his mark as a ghost investigator, became one of the featured teen members in the Ghost Hunter TV series. But he's been drawn to the UFO mystery, and now the two of them find themselves sort of smack dab in the middle of what appears to be a multifaceted but well-connected mosaic of strange subjects, the oft-sought, elusive, all-encompassing theory of universal weirdness, which I have mentioned from time to time on this program. So tonight, with Barry and Steve, we'll hear about UFO cases, ghost investigations, animal mutilations, ancient mummies, and some new evidence which these experienced gumshoes believe tie it all together. I had a chance to speak with both of our guests earlier this year at an event in LA, and I've been looking forward to spending a full 4 hours talking about their work and findings, and that starts in a few minutes. A news story grabbed my eye today. It's about a future robotic mission to Mars. The next rover that's launched to the Red Planet will include a helicopter. The plans to launch this next summer, if all goes well, instead of just having a rover that kind of slowly crawls across the Martian surface, NASA will have its own mini helicopter. And of course, it could cover so much more of the Martian surface and still presumably be able to send images back to Earth. That technology is already being developed and tested, and that would be pretty amazing to see, and it's not too far in the distant future. Also, saw a news item sent to me by someone, a startling headline, Russian spy plane flies over Area 51. Turns out that's true. Our good friends, the Russians, you know, our allies, our pals and all, sent a sophisticated spy plane over Area 51, also over Area 52. And Edwards Air Force Base, and China Lake, and a couple of other choice locations. It's like a spy plane's greatest hits, but this was done with the full knowledge and permission of the U.S. government because we signed the Open Skies Treaty, which gives the Russians permission to schedule flights over sensitive American facilities, including the most sensitive of all, Groom Lake. I am guessing the folks out there at Groom Lake were able to pull a tarp over whatever they didn't want anyone else to see, or more likely hauled it indoors away from prying eyes. 30 years ago this past Friday, we had an anniversary of sorts. I mentioned it a moment ago. A group of people from Las Vegas traveled out into the desert outside of Groom Lake, outside of Area 51, pointed a camera toward Papoose Dry Lake Bed, and waited. They waited until a bright, glowing, disc-shaped object rose over the mountain ridge, looked like it was going to explode at one point, then it dipped back down. It was recorded on video, and Bob Lazar is the guy who led the expedition. It eventually, as we know, led to big trouble for him, but you have to ask, how did he know? Especially since the official position of our government is there has never been a base or even a facility or any kind of test equipment at Papoose Lake, nothing whatsoever. But there was something out there that night. And a week earlier, too. Anyway, a Coast listener named Sander Mulder, who's followed the story for many years, did some analysis of that original video and the commentary provided by Lazar in a recent film that we've talked about on this program a couple of times. I thought you might want to see what Sander put together, so webmaster Greg Bishop and I included it in our usual assortment of items and oddities we culled from various media sites around the world. We call it Naps News. You can find it on the Coast website. We also have a link to the story about the Russian overflight of Area 51, a short think piece about crazy ideas, how crazy ideas, or what seem like crazy ideas, can suddenly become not so crazy and change the world, thinking out of the box, as the cliche goes. Ever notice your dog or cat staring up at a corner of the ceiling or some other place as if there's something there to see and there really isn't anything that you can tell? Maybe they're looking at something unusual? Well, there is some speculation that dogs and cats can and do see phenomena beyond the range of humans. We have a story about it, along with a brief history of the boogeyman, that and more in tonight's Naps News. And while you're on the Coast website, check out how to become a Coast Insider. A yearly subscription costs pennies a day, gives you access to a vast archive of 1,000 or more programs. You can listen anytime you want, as often as you want, on just about any device. It's a good deal. You can also subscribe to George Norrie's television program, Beyond Belief, which covers many similar topics and guests as we cover here on the radio show. George is taking his live stage performance out on the road again this year, might be coming to a town near you. We'll have some information on that a little bit later in the program, and you can find it now on the website. With that, let's assume the position. Bring in the dog and the cat and the chicken and the lizard. Put on a pot of Joe. Slide your bod into your favorite jammies. Break out the bunny slippers, plop yourself down in the Barca lounger, turn down the lights, and turn up the radio, because we're about ready to rumble. In a moment, The Unified Theory of Weirdness with Steve Mira and Barry Fitzgerald. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Is there a unified theory of weirdness, some sort of connection between various aspects of what we call paranormal, supernatural, even alien? You know, it's a question we've raised many times on this program, and it's something I've pursued on my own for a long time. I morphed from the journalistic pursuit of nuts and bolts flying saucer tales to a broader perspective about seemingly unrelated mysteries. And that happened in large part because of the writings of Jacques Vallée and the investigation of a place called Skinwalker Ranch, which is where so many different unexplained phenomena have been reported for many, many years. Are they all connected somehow? That's what the scientists and investigators have wondered. And it's the same question my guests tonight have been asking. It's the same place their research into unusual phenomena has taken both of them, though from different starting points. Both are well known in their home countries and around the world for books and television projects, jointly and separately. And tonight we have them both. Stephen Mira is one of the UK's most respected researchers in the realms of ufology, unexplained and supernatural. He's been on multiple television programs. He's also the CEO of Phenomena Magazine, the world's largest e-zine of its kind, distributed in 12 countries, and he's the founder of the scientific establishment of parapsychology. Irish-born Barry Fitzgerald has nearly 30-plus years' experience in the world of supernatural, which has taken him all over the planet, investigating various kinds of mysteries. As I mentioned before, looking into ghosts and the supernatural and the paranormal. He's written multiple books, and he says he's exposed a global network of doorways which could lead to the true gods behind the veil. Stephen, Barry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having us, George. It's great to meet you again.
Am I correct in saying, Stephen, am I correct? This is the first time you guys have been on this show, live anyway?
I believe so, George. Yes, we've been very busy over the last 30-odd years doing lots of research and gathering our data. But it is time that we distribute some information.
Well, it's definitely overdue. Barry, I'm going to start with you. You know, in the beginning of the program, I characterized, well, both of you as coming at this point in your research from different starting points. Stephen, from the UFO angle, and you, Barry, from the ghost hunter supernatural angle. And I want to make sure I'm being accurate in that assessment. Barry, can you tell us, you have 30-plus years experience chasing the unknown. How did it start? And did it start with what we might call ghosts, or did it start with something else?
No, it pretty much did start with ghosts for me. back in the day, whenever I was a child, like many other researchers, it begins by exposure to this particular phenomenon, and I was no exception. And growing up in a house in Ireland that possessed that type of activity was my initial dipping of the toe of my toe into that tepid water of the paranormal. And you know, my parents were very well aware that the house had a reputation, but they never told the children. So for me, one particular evening, it was actually Christmas Eve, and I woke up with a terrible thirst, and I needed to go down to the kitchen to get some water. And as I started to climb down the stairs, I had a habit of looking over the banister to this double staircase. And that's whenever this figure was coming up the stairs, who I didn't recognize. And initially, you know, being a child, Christmas Eve, I thought it was Santa. I was caught. There was going to be no gifts that year. And I raced back to bed. But it was years later that I spoke to my parents about this. And I was told then that they had been seeing things as well within the house, but they wanted to shelter us from it. It was a strange thing, George, because I have nothing but great memories of that particular house. We had an amazing childhood, yet my dreams are plagued by nightmares of that house, knowing that there's something in it that I can't allow other people to experience. I have to warn them to get out of that house. And yet, in memory, in physical memory, I have no recall of anything of that nature except for seeing the person on the stairs. But yes, that was my initial introduction, if you like, as a child way back in the day, to this whole world of the paranormal, which then exposed itself into this huger aspect.
So years later, that plants the seed, and years later, you devote your life to it.
Pretty much. Well, it's not so much that I gave my life over to it. It's the fact that it really feels as if you've been chosen to do this. I have tried to step away many times, and sooner or later that road comes back around again. And eventually I give into it, and I said, okay, it feels like I'm the backseat passenger in the car of destiny being driven by someone else.
You know, I saw a video, a film that had been done about you investigating. I know you've done ghost hunting work all over the world and here in the States, but it was about you investigating haunted houses and haunted buildings in Ireland. I was thinking to myself, isn't that all of them? I mean, I am part Irish. I know there is some sort of connection I can't explain, but seems like the Irish have deep connections to this kind of phenomena.
Yes, we do. I got to say, and I think we all have at a certain level, but it's how we choose to ignore that within the modern sense is something which is pretty unique in itself. It has been known, you know, for years that the Celts had this aspect of tapping into this other side, but in reality, this is global. And we are no different than the Maori in New Zealand or the Zulu of South Africa. We're all the same. We're all experiencing the same things. And this is where the experience came from and the knowledge from the extensive travel that I was doing. When I got to meet all these people, they were experiencing things. Granted, they were putting on a different identification to it, a different mask, if you like. But they were experiencing essentially the same things that we were experiencing in the Northern Hemisphere on our little island. I began to think, well, hold on a second. There's more to this than meets the eye.
Steve, I want to ask you the question from coming at it from a different angle. Am I correct in saying that your introduction to the weird world was UFOs, what we would call nuts and bolts flying saucers, and that led you closer to where Barry is? And him toward you?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. I mean, I had a sighting when I was very young. Those have continued, strangely, to this day. We seem to be in the right place at the right time and look up and see something in the sky. This continues. I know so many people ask, how many UFOs have we seen? Too many to count, to be honest with you. And I cannot and do not think that is coincidence. I think there's an awareness between the phenomena and the observer. So I've actually been part of this and grown up with the subject. But though I was not, not too aware of the paranormal when I was younger, but as I got older, I realized that my grandmother's house was very much haunted, and there were lots of stories from my family about having experiences. Though I had an interest in that field, I studied ufology for many years until I pretty much exhausted the subject within the UK as best as I possibly could. And I ended up realizing that in the 1970s to 1980s, a lot of these UFO reports which were seen did not list the paranormal aspects. And I was very curious as to why not? Why are these not being listed? And I've talked in a number of academic circles and realized very quickly that it seemed more feasible for professionals to talk about the existence of extraterrestrial life possibly visiting Earth than the concept of an apparition. And I realized, well, why is that? And of course, the study that we took then really was to look at the connections and this subject as a whole.
Yeah, that's what we're going to be covering tonight. So I read one of the introductions to a book that you co-wrote about a ghost investigation, and it mentions that in 1996, that is when it really hit you in the face that that there was a connection that that you couldn't, you had to look beyond just UFOs and traditional flying saucer stories. We're talking with Stephen Mira and Barry Fitzgerald about the unified theory of weirdness they've come up with. In a moment, we'll get into some specifics. We're talking with Stephen Mira and Barry Fitzgerald about the unified theory of weirdness and continue that conversation, see how they arrived at the point where they're at now in just a moment. George Noory is on the road. He's bringing his live stage show to the Lincoln Theater in Columbus, Ohio, Saturday, May 11th of this year. Special guests include Marianne Winkowski, a certified hypnotist Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and Stan Friedman. They have a band and a live meet and greet after the event, so you can get tickets now. We have information on the website. Back in a moment with more Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Steve Mira, your focus sort of changed in 1996 when you started working on a haunted house case that became a book. Tell me about the case, what changed for you, and what the evidence was.
Absolutely. I mean, for about 16 years, I worked for corporate companies on a confidential basis throughout the United Kingdom. And that involved a lot of offices and companies and businesses which were having unusual disturbances. And that was obviously because they didn't know how to deal with it on a managerial level. What happened was is that we were contacted initially by the Ministry of Defence in regarding one of their buildings in Manchester, which were having some disturbances. And what we realized very quickly is that it became a managerial issue because staff wouldn't work in certain places of the building, and also they wouldn't work past a certain hour of the night. And they were very legitimate in regarding their experiences. There was phenomena taking place. But what was very interesting was that the witnesses were seeing balls of light, George, balls of light traveling around the building, intelligently maneuvering, should we say, through open doorways. Now, these balls of light were not only seen, but witnessed by many people there and recorded on CCTV camera by security officers. And they described them as basketball-sized, very bright white balls of light, which were silent, were seen moving down corridors, turning into rooms. And that really interests me because it wasn't the first time I'd seen balls of light, especially in regards to what we've seen in the night sky. And as the years passed, we had many balls of light seen over Mexico City. And I'm trying to work out, are these actually, well, it's an unidentified, it's flying and it's an object. Is there any ruling in regards to what size these things should be? And why would they be associated with the paranormal disturbances inside a building? And that's what really got me thinking in regards a connection between these phenomena.
So the Ministry of Defense is among the parties that were asking you for help in this. Were you able to help them?
I was, yes. Well, what we actually managed to do was, of course, the building had a lot of natural EMF, which had been generated by equipment. We managed to bring that down, EMF effect, in certain areas because of the way it was laid out, the offices. They did, I think they took a plan out of, I think it was $250,000 to redesign the offices and the equipment. And of course, there was a lot of history at this building. There was paranormal things taking place. And of course, nobody can actually go in there, I believe, and say, we can get rid of this phenomenon. I certainly think they have the upper hand. But at the end of the day, it was more about dealing with the people who have those experiences and how to manage them. So we decided to write a protocol about how to deal with paranormal phenomena, which really led us into working for the next 17 years for corporate companies, including the London CID, the Criminal Investigation Department, numerous police departments as well around the UK, and a major shopping outlet, hotel rooms, even football grounds as well, of all things. It was very interesting work. Yes, there was certainly a lot of things taking place, and it surprised me how much is actually does go on which is not known, and that this information doesn't get out to the general public because it's damaging to businesses. They don't want this information out. And at the end of the day, we ended up working for 5 years solid for housing associations because people were reporting things happening of a strange occurrences in buildings around the UK, which they were renting. And of course, that's not good for a business that wants to rent their home. So obviously, we designed a protocol on how to deal with this, how to manage the situation that it doesn't go to the media and causes problems for the company, and most of all, how to deal with the witnesses when they're having these experiences. How, because at the top of our list was their concern and how they are and how they react to this phenomenon. It can be very traumatic for some, but we were certainly seeing aspects of this phenomenon. We had apportations take place. Now, it's a very rare phenomenon. It does take place mostly within the field of poltergeist infestations. But we were lucky, very lucky, to manage to analyse an apport. I mean, this was, in fact, a mug that was placed on the side and completely disappeared and only turned up, then over about an hour and a half later, in the most obvious place. And we managed to analyse that against one of the other mugs, which was a kind of a normal mug. These had come as a set. And under the microscopy, under the microscope, there were several tests carried out. We realised very quickly that we had to question, is the mug that disappeared really the mug that was returned? So it looks the same and weighs the same. In fact, under the microscope, it was not the same. It would seem there's evidence to show that there's a diathermic reaction taking place within this mug. Now, then, I'd seen this with reference before, and when I carried out some research, I realised very quickly that the manifestation of UFOs, sometimes close to the ground, causes effects on plants, and those plants are shown to see that diathermic reaction taking place in them. So it would seem, from the evidence that we've gathered, that in the paranormal manifestation of a mug, or the manifestation of a UFO close to ground, the effects in the given area seem to be the same physics that's involved. And that was kind of another tick in our box, connecting these two phenomena.
We'll come back to the mechanism that you describe in a bit. Barry, I wanted to ask you, you know, when we chatted in Los Angeles earlier this year, I mentioned to you, and I realize you have had the same observation, you know, you got ghost people who don't like the UFO people, and the UFO people don't like the Bigfoot people, and none of them like the crop circle people, and everybody has their niche, and they don't want to talk to the other groups. Was that the way it was for you in terms of your view of UFOs, that part of the mystery?
Initially, at the beginning, yes. You know, I would not have seen the connection with the UFOs and everything else in my early days. It was only through experience that I was able to start to see these connections. And that was actually quite profound to see these connections. And also coming from my research path into aspects of an understanding our mythology, our folklore, and our ancestors, you know, analyzing the texts that were left behind from our ancestors, we started to see commonalities that they were experiencing that were, you could quite easily migrate that across to a present-day encounter with the UFO. And even from the aspect of mutilations, because the mutilations were happening here in Ireland way before 1945. In fact, there's quite, I believe you interviewed two Irish guys there, Dermot Butler and Kyle Nally, in regard to their book, the Circle of Deceit, which speaks of a farm in the north of the country where one particular farmer has lost over 500 head of his livestock. He's getting no answers to this whatsoever in very unusual circumstances. So these things are still going on, but our ancestors, they were experiencing these things as well. And then whenever I started pulling all this together, we started and met up with Steve, and Steve came to Ireland And I brought Steve to one of the locations that historically was known as one of these doorways to this other place. And timing, as Steve had has heard me say many times, timing is essential. Timing is everything. And I marched them up the side of a mountain to get to this place. And lo and behold, we descended into this cavern, and on a return to the surface, that's whenever we had the experience. Someone from inside that cavern spoke to us while the cameras were rolling, and spoke to us in a language that we did not recognize. And again, it comes back to timing and something that our ancestors had experienced hundreds, if not thousands of years before. And seeing this connection and understanding that the mask continually changed was a huge wake-up call for me, because then I started to look at other phenomena within the field, such as the nighttime attacks. The reasons that the nighttime attacks were happening, and I have experienced the nighttime attacks myself, and this is one of the things, when you start studying this particular phenomena, almost like the old saying, you know, don't stare into the abyss because the abyss stares back, that is what was happening, and I attracted the attention of these particular nighttime attacks. But having that
experience... Hold on a second. Nighttime attacks, like what kind of attacks? What do you mean?
Whenever we talk about nighttime attacks, I mean these creatures that will come to the sanctity of your bedroom, and before they move toward the person, you're hit with this particular infliction in which you can't move. A lot of people would say today they would paint it with the same brush and say, oh well, that's just paralysis, sleep paralysis. But this is not the case. This was something very separate, and we shouldn't make the mistake of saying sleep paralysis is the same as nighttime attacks. They are not. They are very, very different. And it was during this particular attack, whenever this person, this entity, had came toward me, that I was understanding what was happening at that particular time. I was able to analyze it enough to understand, and through that particular process, we have now been able to see connections between this particular phenomenon within the paranormal, this nighttime attack, and what was happening in particular to the females of the human species. Nine times out of ten, they'll attack the females more so than the males. And that comes down to just one particular component, and that is iron. Iron is the key thing within our blood that they cannot attack when it's at regular levels. They attack the women during the monthly cycles when they become anemic. And this is something that we also saw migrating across into ufology. This was a huge breakthrough for us. But again, this is something that our ancestors have been talking about from centuries ago. They knew that iron in itself, in its core, could disrupt and keep away elements of, let's say, for instance, from an Irish perspective, the fairy. And I know that in the modern age we've got this idea of fairy, like Tinkerbell and stuff like that, but that's nothing of to what they actually are. But the iron, the element of iron, was the thing that kept them away. This iron has a way of interfering. If we wear the iron as a talisman, for instance, it can interfere during an abduction scenario, and stop the shutdown of the body to the fact that we can't move. It allows us that freedom to move. And when we move, what happens to a human when they're afraid and someone is in the room, we become dangerous. And that in itself is a component in which they are afraid of when they come through to try and do what they do over the course of the millennia of what they've been doing. But iron was the key point, and that in itself allowed us then to migrate that information across into the UFO investigators training course. Because this particular course that we've developed, Steve and I have developed, is exceptionally extensive. But what we do is we address this aspect of the researcher and understand what our bodies do, because nobody else was dealing with this particular aspect. We needed to look after ourselves, first of all. We needed to understand the dangers that are involved, and there are dangers involved with investigating this particular field, because it's a field of many different aspects. It's not just ufology. It's right across the board. So understanding that there was a conscious connection and everything else was something that really set us on the path to where we were going. But we needed to understand biologically who we were and what we can do and how aspects of our biology were being manipulated to allow them to do what they did to us.
It's also geographical, right? Steve, I think you were telling me in Los Angeles that you figured out a way to identify hotspots or places where this is more likely to occur. Can you describe the mechanism?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. It would seem, I mean, we did some research, and it was in back in the 1980s, I think it was an author known as Colonel Philip Corso, who gave reference, I think it was in 1982, that the U.S. government were actually focusing on several positive magnetic anomalies in connection to the UFO phenomena. That led us down a path of conducting surveys and research and traveling around the world. And what we realized very quickly is that a lot of these major documented UFO incidents are actually taking place in areas of positive magnetic anomalies. But what was also interesting is when we conducted further surveys, we realized that not only is the paranormal phenomena connected and UFOs connected, but there's also cryptid sightings of strange creatures, Bigfoot, dogmen, you name it, in those particular areas. And then we don't think that's by chance. We've listed thousands of different cases worldwide now. So what we've done is we've visited these locations and put them under test and witnessed phenomena firsthand as these objects have appeared in those locations. There's definitely a connection with UFOs and these positive magnetic anomalies, which are situated all around the world.
I'm sorry that I don't know the answer to this already, but do they shift? Do the locations shift in time? Or they always stay the same? Does the
magnetic anomalies tend to be pretty much fixed where they're set, George, but over the course of 24 hours, they will expand and contract. So their borders do continually shift, but the core tends to be the same. However, now we're living in a very, very unique time within our development, because now we have got the North Pole, the magnetic North Pole, shifting, and now it's heading towards Siberia. And that in itself seems to be having an effect on the magnetics on the planet itself. And we're seeing certain magnetic anomalies weakening, which before were very, very powerful. And places where these doorways were able to open and shift back again. So the rule book, in its sense, is changing for us, and that's something that we're adapting to try and keep on top of this.
We're talking with Steve Mira and Barry Fitzgerald about the unified theory of weirdness, how to locate hotspots, portals, if you will. In a moment, we'll get into some specific examples, places they've visited and things they've seen,